Another movement that helped to lay the groundwork or to set the stage, so to speak, for the Protestant Reformation, which would follow, was the Renaissance. And no doubt the Renaissance is best remembered today for its artistic contributions. In fact, if I were to list the names of various political leaders or military leaders during that time, you probably wouldn't recognize a single name. But if I were to mention names like Da Vinci, Raphael, Michelangelo, the Renaissance is best remembered for the contribution of various gifted artists and the great artistic works that they created more than anything else. However, in the opinion of many church historians, the Renaissance was most significant because it shed light on much of the ignorance and darkness which had characterized the Middle Ages. And it also prepared the Western world and Western culture specifically for the intellectual claims and challenges of the Protestant Reformation. The intellectual claims and challenges of the Protestant Reformation. Which does suggest that the Reformation really was a thinking man's movement, because there was intellectual ground that had to be plowed to prepare men to receive, to contemplate, and to implement the themes of the Reformation. Again, remember how the church was in the Middle Ages. So something needed to happen in order to prepare men for what would come with the Reformation, and the Renaissance helped to do that. In fact, in assessing the importance of the Renaissance to the Protestant Reformation, N.R. Needham, in his book 2,000 Years of Christ Power, writes, "Few have doubted the significance of the Renaissance, especially in church history, as a forerunner of the Reformation." A forerunner. And that's a distinctively Christian slant on the Renaissance. If you were to go to a local community college and take a class on Western civilization and deal with the Renaissance, your instructor is not going to stand up and say the Renaissance was a forerunner to the Protestant Reformation. But because we do believe in the providence of God, and that history is His story, and that God is constantly preparing men to receive the gospel, then in that sense the Renaissance was a forerunner to the Reformation. And no doubt another reason for this is that so many of the reformers themselves were directly affected by Renaissance thinking, and their works truly show it. So I guess we could put it in this way. Many of the great minds associated with the Protestant Reformation were minds that were nurtured under the influences, many of the positive influences of the Renaissance. And then, of course, they passed on their learning to us. So we need to understand the Renaissance and its significance before we can really understand and appreciate the Reformation, because the Renaissance went before it. And I've created a very crude timeline over here. You can just direct your attention to it. These are the individuals that we've considered thus far: Wycliffe, Huss, Savonarola. I mentioned Luther, and of course the nailing of the thesis to the door of Castle Church in Wittenberg. So you see kind of the progression over time here. Just to let you know, the Renaissance starts in the second half of the 14th century, which I've marked here is basically toward the end of Wycliffe's life. Obviously, middle of Huss's life. So the Renaissance, in all honesty, because it started in Italy primarily in its early stages, may not have had a profound influence on Wycliffe and Huss. But if you see Savonarola's life and where that falls, you know, when he's born, the Renaissance is well underway. And as I mentioned to you before, the city that he was born in was affected by the Renaissance. And in Florence, where Savonarola goes to minister, is the center of the Italian Renaissance. And then we see that the Renaissance goes on from the late half of the 14th century until the Reformation begins in the 16th century. And there's a lot of debate as to when the Reformation officially began. Some say it would, you know, begin with Luther nailing his thesis on the door. Others would say that the date was a little later or a little earlier, and would point to other significant events. So anyway, that's where the Renaissance falls in. Does everybody see that? Is that clear? Again, I don't want to talk about these concepts in abstraction. I want you to be able to see where they fit in on a historical timeline. Let's start with the question, what was the Renaissance? And again, if we were to consult a secular history book for the answer to this question, that book would probably define the Renaissance somewhat of a generic or nebulous way as a time of cultural, social, intellectual, and political advance within Western civilization. Because as we were joking before we began the class, secular history has a tendency to look at history as always a forward progress, an advance. And so they would point to the Renaissance as a time of rapid advance, where men are actually getting better. And the truth is, all of these aspects were affected. The culture, the society, the intellectual environment, the political environment were all affected in some positive way by the Renaissance in Western Europe. However, a more specific definition of the Renaissance would be this, and I'll repeat it after I go through this definition. The Renaissance was primarily an intellectual movement. The Renaissance was primarily an intellectual movement that developed out of a love of ancient Greek and Roman culture and a desire for its rebirth. Renaissance is from what language? French. And does anybody know what the word Renaissance means? Rebirth. It began with the discovery, or we could argue the rediscovery, of the literature of the ancient Greeks and Romans. Books that we kind of loosely call today the classics. And these works of literature have been largely neglected or suppressed prior to this time. If they were suppressed, who might have been suppressing them? The church? What reason would the church have for suppressing the works of the ancient Greeks and Romans? They're pagan. And that one, people don't have access to them. And if anybody is reading them, they're just probably historians or academians. And they're not available to the common people. And thus, the force of these writings and ideas are not being felt to any large extent at all. And from this discovery or rediscovery came a revival of the classical forms of thought, expression, and action. A revival of the classical forms of thought, expression, and action. So to put it another way, the way that we should think, the way that we should express ourselves, the way that we should take action. How that was taught in the ancient Greek and Roman world. And with this revival of these classical forms of thought, expression, and action came a renewed commitment to the study of certain disciplines. Disciplines like grammar, rhetoric, poetry, history, art, philosophy. What we refer to today as the arts and humanities. The reason these disciplines were important is because it was asserted at that time that through these means, through these forms of thought and expression and action, through these disciplines, grammar and rhetoric, and poetry and history and philosophy, a natural human being could be transformed into a truly cultured human being. And then the logic goes a little bit further. If human beings can be transformed from natural brute human beings into truly cultured human beings, then what can happen to cultures? That cultures can be transformed. And if individual cultures can be transformed, and all the cultures are transformed, then what can happen? That there could be a genuine rebirth, not just in the individual, not just in the individual society, but in all the world. So, in a way, these forms are seen as being somewhat of a savior, aren't they? Thus, the Renaissance was an intellectual movement focused on the transformation of man and of mankind. This movement began in the second half of the 14th century, and it eventually spread across the whole of Western Europe, ending sometime in the 16th century with the arrival of the Protestant Reformation. And to be honest with you, the cutoff dates or the start dates are not as clean as we might think. I mean, they didn't just wake up one day and everybody said, this is the end of the Renaissance, and then they woke up the next morning and said, this is the beginning of the Reformation. There was considerable overlap. And this brings up the question, how did the Renaissance affect religious matters throughout Western Europe? Before I proceed, let's just get a polling here of your thoughts about that. Yes, Jeff.
I was going to say that it seems kind of odd that the Roman Catholic Church did embrace some of the Greek thought, like Aristotle, and even persecuted Galileo. He was trying to break away from that way of thinking.
It's true. But as we'll see, and I don't have time to elaborate on this, the Roman Catholic Church did imbibe many of the thoughts of the Renaissance. The emphasis upon beauty, the emphasis upon acquisition of goods, the emphasis upon art. We talked about the Sistine Chapel. You know, if I'm not trying to defend the Roman Catholic Church here, but if the Roman Catholic Church was trying to build something like the Sistine Chapel today, can you imagine what the outcry would be, even among some conscious, socially conscious Roman Catholics about the kind of money that's being spent there? But you know what? In the Renaissance, nobody blinked an eye. Because the Roman Catholic Church just said, we're on the cutting edge of culture. We're on the cutting edge of bringing beauty into the church. Art. Sculptures. See what I'm saying? They imbibe the spirit of the times. Well, let me first state that the Renaissance was not an anti-religious movement per se. Sometimes I think people misunderstand this, and they see the Renaissance as a full-on assault against the gospel. Well, certainly there were some negative effects, and we'll talk about that. But the Renaissance was not an anti-religious movement per se. Now, no doubt, there were some during the Renaissance who were so eager to rid themselves of the darkness and the superstition that characterized the Middle Ages that they probably would have welcomed a world that was free of any religious entanglements, where presumably men could reach their potential unhindered and without any kind of opposition. I'm sure there were some who thought that way. But for the most part, the Renaissance did not seek to remove religion from society. In fact, some even viewed the Renaissance as an opportunity to restore humanity and culture to the state that they believe that God had originally intended. Now, there's some flaws in that thinking. You can see how some might think, now we have the means to accomplish what we need to accomplish in bringing culture to where God intended it to be. In fact, next week we're going to talk about a movement called Christian Humanism. This is pretty much the impetus behind Christian Humanism. That God is bringing about all these things, even the emphasis upon man and his ability to accomplish things, to serve God and God's purposes on the earth. There clearly is in that some post-millennial overtones. Brother Rob was kind enough to mention post-millennialism to us earlier, but there is what was common in this thought of postmillennialism is that there can be a golden age. Okay? There can be this ultimate golden age, this perfect human society, or as Thomas More would say, utopia. And so some believe that the Renaissance was an opportunity to improve or to change religion for the better. Yet with all of its lofty goals, we must recognize that the Renaissance did have some real negative effects upon religious matters. Let me just list three of these negative effects very quickly. And by the way, the floor is open for comments or questions, so please feel free. Number one, the Renaissance affected religion and the cause of Christianity negatively because it shifted people's focus away from salvation and the life to come to the present or the here and now instead. Shifted people's focus away from salvation and the life to come to the present world or to the here and now instead. In the Middle Ages, the claims had been upon, or the focus had been upon, the claims of heaven. In a very wicked sense, the Middle Age church had really exploited that. But during the Renaissance, the focus was now more upon the claims of earth, man's right to reach his potential, God's desire that man have a perfect society, God's blessings in bringing about the means to now accomplish those things on earth. And more specifically, the focus was on how to restore human society through learning, culture, the arts, etc., so that mankind could become the city of God, which they claimed that God intended all along. Now, some of you may remember in our earlier studies in church history that we talked about the works of Augustine. And Augustine wrote a book that was very influential in that day called The City of God. Well, the basic thrust of that book is that there is present a city of man and a city of God. And the city of man is pagan man, unsaved man, natural man. The city of God is the church. And it's God's intention that the city of God flourish on the earth. And that became synonymous with the church. And then the church's impetus was to go out and to affect everything in life to bring about the furtherance of that city of God. And many people were now beginning to think that maybe the way that we obtained the city of God and all that God intended for man was through the emphasis of the Renaissance. Secondly, the Renaissance affected religion and the cause of Christianity negatively because it emphasized the natural goodness and unlimited potential of man rather than man's total depravity and need for the grace of God. It emphasized the natural goodness and the limitless power, potential of man rather than man's total depravity and utter need for the grace of God. Jeff, you mentioned this earlier. In fact, in essence, the Renaissance denied man's depravity. In fact, you really couldn't have a Renaissance if you believed that man was depraved. Because if you believe man's depraved, you realize that man really can't do anything without the grace of God. The Renaissance brought with it a renewed emphasis upon the individual. A renewed emphasis upon the individual and the individual's right for self-expression and for self-development. So you see, the circle's even getting smaller, isn't it? Not just upon man or mankind generically, but even upon the individual. The individual's right under God for self-expression and self-development. This could be seen especially in the arts and in literature. I'll give you some examples. For example, in the area of the arts, under the Renaissance, there was a growing demand for self-portraits, for non-religious portraits. Now, if you know anything about art history, think about what's really being painted during the Middle Ages. I mean, you really weren't a legitimate painter unless you were painting something for the church or something biblical. In the Renaissance, they break out of that mold, and now you start seeing non-religious portraits, and you start seeing self-portraits. Okay? It seems subtle, but there really is a shift going on in emphasis. You can also see it in literature. With the exception of Augustine's Confessions, it was very unusual for anyone to write anything concerning themselves in an autobiographical manner. But in the Renaissance, we suddenly see an explosion of literary biographies. You see the subtle shift here? Okay? The shift is now coming to the individual and his or her right to self-expression. So now we have people writing the story of their lives now, and that's literature. Whereas before, it really wouldn't have been considered literature. So the glory of man is emphasized, and his fallenness is essentially ignored. Thirdly, the Renaissance affected religion and the cause of Christianity negatively because it revived an interest in classical pagan thought. And it promoted a spirit of worldliness. Brought about a revival of classical pagan thought and a spirit of worldliness. Now, this interest in pagan thought came from reading the pagan writers, right? So if you make the pagan writers available all of a sudden, people are reading the pagan writers and they're thinking, hey, these pagan writers are pretty profound. So you begin to be influenced by their thinking. And the spirit of worldliness brought with it an obsession for riches and excess, which I mentioned a little bit earlier. And this obsession for riches and excess could eventually be seen within the church. Now, according to Wycliffe and Huss, they felt the church was greedy even before the Renaissance. But in the Renaissance, it's almost as if the church felt it had permission to be greedy. And as I mentioned before, that's when, you know, St. Peter's Cathedral and the Sistine Chapel and all these great works of quote-unquote architecture and art are built. Yes?
It's interesting as you see the church taking advantage of that. One of the things that I remember from Luther is the opposition to the selling of indulgences.
Right.
Why did they do it? Well, they paid for all of those excesses.
Exactly. Exactly. Indulgences paid for just about everything that the church wanted. It was the perfect scheme, if you think about it. What do the people need? Well, they need to be delivered from their fear. Fear of death, fear of purgatory, fear of hell. On the other hand, you need money. And you need to have a commodity that's so desirable that would bring a person so much satisfaction that they wouldn't hesitate, you know, to sell their goods or whatever they had to obtain it, even if they were poor. So, send somebody else out to sell indulgences and the people buy it. Yeah, perfect scheme. And indulgences really, you know, begin to flourish beginning in this time frame. Remember, Huss was against the sale of indulgences for the funding of a war. But you also see indulgences kind of increasing because the church has a lot of projects going on. Remember Tetzel? I mean, he's out there, he's out raising money. What's he raising money for? Does anybody remember? Something's going on in Rome. Yeah. St. Peter's Basilica. Huge place. Doesn't build itself. Isn't free. So it's no mere coincidence that the selling of indulgences is timed with those types of architectural and artistic projects. It's kind of getting off the track, but we do have to understand that with the Renaissance came this spirit of worldliness and this obsession with riches in excess. So the Renaissance undermined true religion in several ways. However, it also had positive effects for religion, and especially for the cause of Christianity. And let me mention three positive effects. And again, this is an attempt to be honest and balanced, because it would be wrong to simply say that the Renaissance didn't have anything good about it. It was all horrible. There was a lot bad about it, a lot negative, but there were some positive things. Number one, the Renaissance brought a renewed interest in learning. A renewed interest in learning, which included a greater emphasis upon literacy. Now, why would that be important? A greater emphasis upon literacy. People could read the Bible, right? People could read and write. There have been times in the church where, you know, the common people were uneducated, that many of them would spend their whole lives unable to read something. Of course, the Roman Catholic Church, once again, here's a criticism, parlayed that to their advantage, so to speak. And so they said, well, if the people can't write and they can't read, let's not teach them how to write and read. Let's just make things for them. So let's make statues and pictures and things like that in the church, and those will be the sermons that they hear. Those will be the books that they read. So they didn't emphasize literacy. Why? Why would you want to? I mean, all you needed to know as a faithful Roman Catholic is that you need the church and you need to go to Mass. Everything that the priest said or the bishop said is all you really needed to know. The church was your mother. The church would nurture you. You didn't need to question the church. But with the Renaissance came this emphasis upon learning and this emphasis upon literacy. And we find historically that when learning and literacy are emphasized, the gospel has a tendency to flourish in those environments. There's a great deal of wisdom in some missionaries going into lands and basically teaching people to read and write, even before they begin to disciple people in the truths of God's Word. Because they want the people to have those abilities to benefit from the Word of God. So this is a very positive thing. Secondly, the Renaissance created a willingness to look critically at the church. A willingness to look critically at the church, and namely the Roman Catholic Church, and to call attention to its oppressive practices and abuses. Because again, if the emphasis now is upon the individual's right for self-expression and for self-development, you begin to look at the church around you and you begin to say, you know what? The church doesn't seem to be emphasizing those things. In fact, in some ways, the church seems to be an enemy of self-expression and self-development. The church seems to be an enemy of learning and literacy. And with that mindset, they began to look critically at the church. Yes. So, people are now willing to look critically at the church. And the Renaissance, in a sense, kind of gives them the permission to do that. Church has not wanted them to look critically. But with this emphasis upon learning, literacy, on freedom of expression, self-development, people began to look critically at the church. And thirdly, the Renaissance nurtured a commitment to go back to the primary sources of Western learning. This is really important. You might want to put a star beside this one. The Renaissance emphasized or nurtured a commitment to go back to the primary sources of Western learning. Because again, the idea is if we can go back to the primary sources, we can rediscover how to change society, and we can even rediscover how to change the church. So primary sources became the mantra. And I want you to think for a few minutes where that would lead people. Where it would lead people if we're going back to the primary sources.
Greek New Testament.
Greek New Testament.
Was there a lot more Bible translations that occurred in that time?
Exactly. Because not only do you need to go back to the primary source, you need to make the primary sources available, don't you? So for the pagans, that meant, well, go back to the classics. And we see during this time a rediscovery of the works of Plato in terms of the secular emphasis. Now, Aristotle had already been rediscovered by the Western world. You may remember that a couple of years ago when we talked about the scholastic period, the schoolmen, and how the Muslims had rediscovered the writings of Aristotle. And they were kind of on the cutting edge of learning at that time. The church wanted to respond to that. So the church then rediscovered Aristotle. And then the schoolmen, Thomas Aquinas and others, they really developed a whole system of theology based upon Aristotle's philosophy. But Plato was not emphasized. He kind of lay dormant for a long time. But during the Renaissance, there was a rediscovery of the works of Plato. If you remember some of the works of Plato, they were pretty significant. Anybody remember a work called Plato's Republic? What kind of radical thoughts would be in Plato's Republic? Okay? Well, basically, Plato's Republic is talking about the ideal republic. The ideal political apparatus, so to speak, for ultimate happiness. A civilized cultural society. Well, I'll tell you what, there's some pretty threatening thoughts in Plato's works, according to some people. But we see a rediscovery of the works of Plato. And then, as Jeff has mentioned, and as Mike has mentioned, for the Christians, this emphasis on going back to the primary sources created a demand that the theologians of the church return to the original languages, to Hebrew and to Greek. And of course, this resulted in the scriptures being placed in the hands of the people, ultimately. And so, it's no accident that suddenly there's this emphasis upon going back and finding faithful manuscripts of Greek with the ultimate desire of translating those Greek manuscripts into the language of the people. And a very prominent Christian humanist, who we'll talk about next week, Lord willing, played a big part in that. And his name is Erasmus of Rotterdam. Okay? He is coming up through this period. He's affected by the Renaissance and Renaissance thinking. And he uses his considerable abilities to bring together Greek manuscripts for the purpose of ultimately translating the Greek New Testament. And those who would go on to translate the Greek manuscripts into English would be indebted to all the work that around to kind of unlock the keys, as it were. Also, I should mention this for those of you who are interested in the development of theology. There was also, at this same time, a rediscovery of sorts of the works of Augustine. When the schoolmen came to prominence in the Middle Ages, again, the schoolmen were the scholastics in the Roman Catholic Church, they strongly favored other works other than Augustine. And in time, Roman Catholic theology, for the most part, would be driven by the theological system of Thomas Aquinas, who was a schoolman. So, in a very real sense, there was not a lot of emphasis upon Augustine. But with this rediscovery of Augustine came a rediscovery of many of Augustine's themes, such as the sovereignty of God and salvation. And it's really interesting to look at some of the reading of the Reformers. If you'll look at Calvin's Institutes, for example, you'll see in Volume 1 especially, that Calvin keeps going back to Augustine. He just does a frog leap, as it were, right over Thomas Aquinas and Schoolmen and Scholastic period, and he goes all the way back to Augustine. Well, Calvin's ability to do that really resulted from a rediscovery of the works of Augustine prior to that period, where Calvin then has access to that. He reads from it, and it molds and changes his theology. Also, Luther is profoundly affected by Augustine. Luther's a little bit later in this period. But Luther's soteriology is also formed by this renewed emphasis upon the teachings of Augustine. This is all significance in terms of the development, the rediscovery, as it were, of Reformed theology within the church. So the Renaissance was a movement that demanded that man and society move forward through learning, by going back through the primary sources, and by recapturing freedom of thought and expression which they believe had been lost or stolen. And that's basically the thought process that drove them. And this movement, called the Renaissance, spread rapidly. The Renaissance at its best was primarily a desire to bring man and culture out of the superstition and darkness of the Middle Ages, to give men and society access to ancient Greek and Roman thought and to classical forms of learning, with the idea that that would basically deliver man, bring about a rebirth of man and society. That's basically what it was. But there were some Christians who, heavily influenced by the emphasis of the Renaissance, who certainly attempted to Christianize that movement and would see it more as a blessing of God and an opportunity to look critically at the church, to go back to the primary church. The only problem I had with what you just said is what you said kind of frames the Renaissance as a Christian movement. Whereas I think there were things within the Renaissance that helped the cause of Christianity. But it really wasn't a Christian movement in that the thinkers of the Renaissance were not directing people back to the Bible in terms of its secular advancement. They were directing people back to pagan thought. But what happened was, since there was this emphasis on going back to the original sources, then in the grace of God, some Christians thought, well, the church needs to do the same thing. It needs to go back to the original sources. It needs to go back to the Greek and Hebrew. And when the church went back to Greek and Hebrew, to be honest with you, that's when the chains began to fall off. I mean, perfect example is Luther. You know, Luther, in the providence of God, is closed in, and he's a teacher. And he's lecturing through the Psalms and Romans and Galatians. And what he has for his source is the Greek New Testament. His access to that Greek New Testament is remarkable. And as he begins to work his way through the Greek New Testament, his eyes are open. But with the Renaissance, there isn't so much a desire to go back and rediscover that aspect. Basically, coming out of the Middle Ages, most people felt, most intellectual thinking people at this time, I can't speak for the common person. I mean, who knows what the common person was thinking in some of these contexts. But if we read the writings that were produced within this period, most people felt that the Middle Ages was not a good experience. Okay? That it was characterized by superstition and ignorance. The only way to prevent that from happening again, the only way to lead culture out of that, was to have a rebirth. Cultural, intellectual, political
And the question is, how do we do that? Well, then the idea is, and this is common even today, that the way that we do it is we go back to a purer time. We go back to a better time, a time when people did it a lot better. So, to them, you know, they were infatuated with the Greek and Roman culture. And they thought, man, that was society as it should be. So they brought those writings back, and they were going to transform society. And this is not one of the Christian emphasis. They're going to transform society, not through the gospel, but they're going to transform society through these classical means that we discuss.
So then elevating the taxes above the Christian
law. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As I said when I talked about the negative effects, it basically, you know, put the emphasis away from salvation and the claims of heaven and focused on how to bring about transformation on earth. It kind of implied that man was the captain of his own destiny. That through intellectual pursuits and accomplishments, through the use of all these forms and means of learning, that man could, in a sense, kind of bring about his own cultural and societal redemption.
Were they either thinking as far as think they could make a world where Jesus would then appear in as a world ready for his personal visit?
No, there was not an emphasis on preparing the world for Jesus' return. Okay? In fact, you know, the main thrust of the Renaissance is not that they're readying the world for the return of God. I'm not saying that nobody ever thought that. I'm just saying that's not the predominant thought. The predominant thought was that man could continue to advance, that he would continue to grow, that he would be cultured, and it would produce a more cultured society as time went on through these means. What may have directed your thoughts in this way is I did say that there were some Christians who did imbibe all of this emphasis of the Renaissance and tried to steer it in a more Christian direction. And so they took all these positive effects of the Renaissance and they directed them toward the good of individual Christians, the good of the church, the good of the church's goals and agenda, and they really focused in that way.
Right.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it, because again, when I was going through this, I wanted to emphasize the word transformation as I was speaking of the goals of the Renaissance, okay, as though it were something man could accomplish on his own, that he could transform himself from the natural man to a really cultured man. And that was really the goal. It wasn't so much heaven was the goal. It was that we'd have a truly cultured man. The Renaissance was not a distinctively Christian movement, although God used it to prepare men for the Reformation. And mostly to prepare men intellectually, since it was an intellectual movement, for the claims and the things that would be emphasized during the Reformation. Okay. That's the shortest summary I can. And you know I'm not good at summarizing. I've been running on for 5 minutes saying the same things. All right, let's talk about the spread of the Renaissance through Western Europe. I just want to make a few brief statements on the spread of the Renaissance in four countries. They're listed on your outline. First one being Italy, second Germany, third France, fourth England. For the most part, the Renaissance arose first in Italy. And what's the significance of Italy? Well, Italy is the ancient heartland for the Roman Empire, isn't it? So it arose first in Italy in the second half of the 14th century. It was in Italy and in the city of Florence that a rediscovery of the early Greek fathers took place. And when I say Greek fathers there, I mean that in a generic sense. I don't mean the Greek church fathers, the Greek fathers. Especially the works of Plato. soon a Platonic academy was established. In the works of Aristotle and Scholastic Roman Catholic theology, which was based upon Aristotle, was rejected. There was also a revival in Italy of the visual arts. We talked about that before. The Renaissance then spread to Germany, France, and England. So the next three, it spread to all of them about the same time. And the reason it spread to those three countries was largely because of the invention of a remarkable device. Does anybody know what that is? Yes, exactly. The invention of printing by movable type, especially. Anybody know what we mean by movable type? Printing was done initially. You had to set up printing in such a way that it was very laborious and cumbersome and time-consuming, because the type was not movable, easily replaced. Very expensive. Yeah, and it just hindered things being printed. Yes?
I was just going to say, movable type is you can pick a letter and move it wherever you want it.
Right. So by doing that, having movable type, it was inexpensive, and it was easy to change typesets, and it made printing so much easier, and they could produce 100 times more and much quicker than they could before. And everybody knows who the inventor of printing by movable type was, right? I don't have to mention his name. Or maybe I should. Somebody mention his name. Yeah. Johann Gutenberg. And the year that he founded that was the year 1450. Okay? So because of the invention of printing with movable type, the ideas of the Renaissance spread to these other countries, Germany, France, and England. Of course, in the providence of God, isn't it amazing that this printing with movable type was in place and functioning and ready to go when it came time for works related to Reformation in the Church to be disseminated? Remarkable. No mere coincidence. In Germany, the ideas of the Renaissance became more Christianized and nationalized. So what I'm saying by that is, pretty much in Germany, it was the Church that took on the major ideas and themes of the Renaissance. And then, of course, they nationalized it. What I mean by nationalized is it became very much of their part of their national identity. Of course, that happened in Germany a lot, didn't it? Because we talked about John Huss, and we talked about the influence that Huss had in Bohemia and also in Germany. Okay? And ideas became very nationalized very, very quickly. In France, the ideas of the Renaissance found considerable support in academic circles. And the main college in France that really produced much of the emphasis upon the Renaissance was called College de France. France today is a very dark land. I mean, you need to pray for David Vaughan. Seriously, there's very little gospel in France today. But, you know, during the Renaissance, there were some keen minds, and during the early days of the Reformation, there were some keen thinkers. Farrell and Calvin both came from France. And then in England, Oxford University would become the center of Renaissance humanism. Notice what I said, Renaissance humanism. But then eventually, over time, would become the center of Protestant Reformed thought. So we see kind of a progression taking place at Oxford University now. The ideas of the Renaissance are embraced by Oxford University, and it should not surprise us that later on, the ideas of the Reformation would then find root at Oxford University, because again, all these things have been stressed and emphasized. So it's in a human sense, it's understandable why they would have an affinity for, an affection for, the thoughts of the Reformation. So this is how the gospel spread throughout Western Europe, particularly in these key countries. It affected other areas, but they were not as significant as these. And I think the point we want to make is that, once again, God is preparing these countries for the Reformation. Because when we begin to look at the Reformation, we will notice that there is a striking parallel between those countries that embraced Renaissance thinking and those countries that were open and ripe for the Protestant Reformation. Okay? Yes?
I'm not trying to support the Roman Catholic Church in this, but it seems like the Reformation, and actually first the Renaissance, flourished where the Roman Catholic Church had it. There's not a lot that we hear, there's not a lot we hear from the Eastern portion of the
Roman
Catholic Church is close to it.
Right. You know, the reason that there was not a Reformation in the Eastern Church is because the Eastern Church had so isolated itself from any new ideas or new thoughts that it was totally unaffected by these movements. Totally. They pride themselves in preserving their culture to the exclusion of other thoughts and ideas. You see, it's in these countries where there is the free exchange of ideas that the gospel enters. And the persuasive power of the gospel, by the power of the Holy Spirit, begins to change and convict and bring about change. The gospel hasn't really penetrated the Eastern Church, in my view. At one time, certainly the gospel was in the Eastern Church, but it became very formalized in a sense, like the Roman Catholic Church did. It essentially rejected justification by faith. It has resisted any kind of input, so it's just kind of been preserved in the state that it's in. But they are right in that it's a very ancient church, and many of their practices are very ancient. But, you know, are those practices biblical is another question. Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, it seems to me, a little off track, but it seems to me like one of the problems that exists in the Muslim world, many of the Muslim countries, is they've never had the experience of anything like that, Renaissance
right.
or Reformation. It was still stuck back in the 7th, 8th, 9th century thinking, in many ways.
Right.
And yet there were intellectual movements within the Muslim.
Yes, there have been. There have been significant intellectual movements within Islam. For lack of a better term, Islam has always been so protectionist. That part of being Islamic is being separated. And when you have a movement like that, you do effectively cut off access to any kind of new ideas or new ways of thinking. I'm not necessarily stressing new ideas, but new ways of thinking or interpretation. But the Renaissance, again, helped kind of create that critical thinking, emphasizing learning, literacy, emphasis upon primary sources. All those things are great things because all those things need to be in place for the Reformation to happen. Well, the Renaissance had a profound effect. I mean, the Renaissance still has an effect on us even today, believe it or not. You know, there are ideas that we have that are from the Renaissance that have not died. And particularly in academic circles, academia still embraces some of the themes of Renaissance. There are still people, even in this day, who believe that the way that man can be transformed and the society can reach its potential is through education and learning. That education and learning is really the source of man's salvation. Bring up a really good point. Now, none of us are experts in this field, and thankfully we're not, but if you listen to the arguments coming out of the homosexual community, for example, they use a lot of the same Renaissance-type thinking. Particularly, in recent years, the academians within the homosexual movement have gone back to early Greek and Roman culture. And they pointed to those cultures as being the truly cultured, enlightened cultures And it just so happens that those cultures had far greater tolerance for homosexuality than our society does today. So they're kind of crying out, as it were, for a rebirth of contemporary society by looking back to that culture as a model. Okay, and that's similar thinking as far as the Renaissance. It's not an exact parallel, but I'm just saying that's the same kind of mindset that is characteristic of Renaissance type thinking. Next Sunday, Lord willing, we will look at the rise of Christian humanism. I will not spend a lot of time explaining humanism, Christian humanism, other than to say, remember what we learned in the Renaissance, and remember there were some humanists who were Christians who tried to carry the ideas of the Renaissance into the Christian realm. We're going to spend more time dealing with Erasmus. I want you to understand who he was and what his contributions were. And then we're going to spend some time talking about the ruinous state of the Roman Catholic Church at this time in history. And then that will complete our subject on the precursors to the Protestant Reformation. And then the next lesson, we'll talk about Martin Luther and the birth of the Reformation. Okay? Does everybody understand where we're going? Great. I hope this material is helpful. Thank you for your interaction. And God bless you. Have a good evening.